CFUV 101.9 FM broadcasts from the Songhees and Wasanich territories, also known as Victoria, BC. You can listen to our music, spoken word, and multicultural programs anywhere, anytime at cfuv.ca.
Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio, recorded September 6th, 2021. Well, with spring approaching down under, citizens there are set to begin a new season under lockdown. For Australians in Victoria State, the sixth COVID-19 lockdown was due to end last week, but days before the deadline, Premier Daniel Andrews' Labor government announced it would be extended in order to, quote, buy time to allow vaccinations to be undertaken. How much time or how many vaccinations it would take to make this latest lockdown go away wasn't made clear, but what's certain is the growing restlessness of the population. Last month, hundreds were arrested during protests of government measures, with the country's second city, Melbourne, seeing the greatest numbers of arrests. John Helmer is a journalist, author, broadcaster, former political advisor to government, and principal behind the news website Dances with Bears. Among Helmer's many book titles are The Lie That Shot Down MH17, Skripal in Prison, and The Man Who Knows Too Much About Russia. His latest is Hitler Didn't Die in Berlin. He moved to Melbourne, where he runs the state government of Victoria, a true COVID-19 thriller. It's the chronicle of his legal battles with authorities that banned both his leaving Australia and allowing his wife rejoin him there. He writes, quote, right now, this is a story with urgent parallels in the UK, US, Canada, Germany, Spain, and France, in every country where democratic resistance to abuse of power in the pandemic has run into identical tactics of lawlessness and suffered the same fate. Today, John Helmer and the search for an inoculant to viral government malfeasance and the disastrous effects of hubris on the body politic. Well, welcome back to the program, John.
Thank you very much, Chris. Great to be healthy.
Well, yeah, well, it's great to hear you healthy, and it's always great to speak with you. Of course, John spoke was February, and then we talked about your newly released book, Hitler Didn't Die in Berlin. He moved to Melbourne, where he runs the state government of Victoria, a true COVID-19 thriller. Well, that we were talking about it, that your book being effectively disappeared by an over-concentrated and blind-eyed media, whited out, in effect. In the interim 7 months, John, have you had any luck getting the book reviewed and read and sold?
No. The book has been more than disappeared, that famous term that applied to the Argentine secret police during the military junta ruling Argentina. Is pretty good comparison to what's happening in Victoria. We don't have a military junta ruling Victoria. There is a medical, political junta ruling Victoria, supported by and enforced by the police and the military. My book is the only one published attempting to document in nice, quiet, calm language. It's even boring to the extent that it looks at statistics, budget numbers, and court action, legal papers, what has happened in the state of Victoria to create a particular fascism, and I use the term advisedly, in its Australian and Victorian form. The book has been banned in Victoria and in New South Wales. No bookshop will carry the book. I've talked to all of them. One brave bookshop in Sydney carried it for a few days and then put it away. The reason I discovered in some bookshops is they're frightened of little Hitler. That's the Victorian, that's the regional state premier, a man called Daniel Andrews. They're frightened because Andrews operates a very large, an enormous social media IT information warfare group, by far the largest in Australia. And what that group does is detect any form of opposition to hostility, threats to expose Andrews for any form of misdoing or wrongdoing and or criticism, and then squelch it. So bookshops are very frightened that if they put the book in the window, if they put the book on display, the book shows a very clear image of Hitler in the bunker, only the head on the Hitler's shoulders is Andrews, that the reaction by the Premier would be to put them out of business. So we have emergency power rule while I've been locked into Australia, not allowed out. And while I've lost my court case against the illegality of the closure of Melbourne Airport, preventing Australian citizens from coming in, while I've lost all of that, the book telling the story has been lost. You can get the book. It's published by Amazon. You can get it easily through the Amazon system. But it's intimidation, fear of the Premier putting the bookseller out of business if the book is seen to be there. But there's been another level of repression and suppression used against me. When I tried to appeal the court case, the judgment of the judge in the case on grounds of prejudice and misreading of the law and a few other things, the tale is told in the book. The court revealed that the audio tapes of the proceedings, because they were done virtually, so everything was tape recorded, the audio tapes have been lost. My, lost. Now, you can't actually lose the digital tape of a court hearing anymore. You have to erase it. So when I've gone to Freedom Information and various other methods, including an investigation by the so-called Judicial Commission in this state of Victoria, every move I've made has protected the court for having, quotes, lost, erased the tapes. So on top of losing the case, this legal system has suppressed all tale of it. But that wasn't the case in Parliament. In Parliament, a brave member of the upper house asked the Attorney General of the state, Andrews, chief lawyer, to answer questions raised by the book. And he mentioned the book in the questions tabled on notice. Those questions have never been answered. They've simply been ignored. And that's another way in which Australian fascism works. The whole story is how Australian fascism works. That is to say, the Premier, Andrews, ignored a direct request for information relating to the book, ignored the question, didn't provide the answer. What those questions went to were such questions as, how much money have you actually spent on the police? How much money have you spent on paying hospitals, private hospitals, constituency-relevant political vote donation hospitals to stay open but not provide services, waiting for a COVID wave that didn't come? In other words, budget questions. In the United States, in Canada, in the UK, elected officials can't refuse to provide that information to Parliament. But in Victoria, that's been the case, A, because the Premier ignores the orders and resolutions, and B, because he suspended Parliament in the current lockdown. So Australian fascism, Victoria style, Daniel Andrews style, suppresses books and protests by intimidation. It cancels or suppresses Parliament or ignores Parliament. It ignores the law, and the courts allow this lawlessness to have a veneer of legality.
About this IT network that you mentioned, is that something that's administered through and by government?
Andrews is one of the new breed of so-called left or Labour politicians. He comes from the Australian Labour Party, left faction in Victoria. These are all ridiculous words. They mean nothing now except factional snouts in big corporate donation troughs. Andrews has assembled a staff, some of which is almost certainly paid for out of the state budgeting for the Premier's office, and some of which is paid for through the party, and that some of those party funds come from unions, some of them come from corporate donors, and some of it comes from other sources, friendly sources to the personality of the Premier, who in turn provides those businesses with all sorts of feeding opportunities at the trough. And COVID-19 Emergency Power Administration has produced an enormous money trough, not only in Australia, obviously, but everywhere. And that trough and the pigs at the trough have all been sorted by those in charge of the pandemic, those in charge of the emergency power, so that they would generate money, rewards for the doctors, votes for the politicians, and so on. That's how it works. Best to call it, I wouldn't call it totalitarianism, Chris, simply because once I was a political science professor, not anymore. It's useless. There's no science. There's no politics. What we have now isn't totalitarianism in the sense that there's a very determined ideological enforcement downwards to a subservient population. What we have is gangsterism, fascism of lawless, where there's lawlessness, emergency, rule by emergency decree without protection, denying the constitutional rights of people and that sort of thing, to the benefit of some members of the gang, to the disadvantage of large numbers of the people. And underneath all of that, you have manipulated opinion polls which don't reveal the extent to which people have had enough of it. People want to resist it. People have come to believe, and this is the great, great disadvantage of this kind of gangsterism, this model of Australian fascism. Underneath it all, people no longer believe the state when it says anything. They no longer believe what they read in the newspapers. They believe the press, the courts, the parliaments, the political parties, and the political leadership have all failed them for their advantage, the disadvantage of majorities. Now, what that turns into is passive resistance to vaccination and all sorts of other forms of opposition, many of which you're seeing in Canada during this election campaign.
What is the mechanism that Andrews is employing to strike fear into the heart of Melbourne's booksellers and presumably others in other fields as well?
Well, the mechanism varies from one bookshop to another. Just to take the bookshop example, one bookshop, which is one of the largest booksellers in the city of Melbourne. The city of Melbourne's a big city by Australian standards, second largest city. I've forgotten its exact numbers, but I think it's between 3 and 4 million now. Pardon me for not remembering. It's the fastest growing city. This very big bookseller is down the hill from Parliament. And in an unguarded moment, the book buyer told me that they're not going to display a book which would offend the people up the street, by which she meant the Parliament. That was one bookseller, for example. Another bookseller in a posh neighborhood, what they did was cute. The owner originally said, she said she'll be very interested. She took a look at the cover. She took a look at the title. She said, this will be very interesting to our clientele here. Subsequently, when I went in to check, I found that the books were being hidden out of sight. When I asked why that was the case, the person in charge of the bookshop told me that the owner and she had agreed not to run the book. And I discovered that this person, the assistant, the bookseller's assistant, had written her owner a note, and I grabbed it while she wasn't looking and then put it on my Twitter account. And what that basically says is, Helmer came in here very angry. He doesn't appreciate that the title of this book will offend our Jewish readers, and the substance of the book will offend those who vote for Andrews. So we're not going to run it. Well, what does that tell you as a system of repression? It tells me it's ludicrous. It was precisely because Hitler was in the title that Jewish readers in that neighborhood were attracted to understand and compare what had happened to many of their families during the Holocaust in Germany and in Poland and so on during World War II. They were interested, but the bookseller turned it on its head.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today to John Helmer. John's a journalist, author, broadcaster. He's a former political advisor to government and principal behind the news website Dances with Bears. Among Helmer's many book titles are The Lie That Shot Down MH17, Skripal in Prison, and The Man Who Knows Too Much About Russia. We're talking today around and about his latest title, Hitler Didn't Die in Berlin. He moved to Melbourne, where he runs the state government of Victoria, a true COVID-19 thriller. Well, John, what about that angle that invoking Hitler and the Nazis is somehow belittling the realities of the Holocaust to not only Jewish people, but others?
I think it's nonsense. I mean, the mechanisms in which a state which has a constitution, which has the protection of the press, parliament, and the law, suddenly turns under emergency powers into a lawless state directed by the premier acting on what he calls medical advice. Let me give you a better example, perhaps, than what's happened to my book. This is a case in which, and you all your listeners understand what this is about. This is a young woman who, a Victorian in Melbourne, arrested by the police for violating the lockdown rules relating to behavior outside of her house. What she'd done was to have gone outside of her house on her way to exercise. Under the lockdown rules in Victoria, Australia, under Andrew's rules, everybody's allowed out of the house for exercise, subject to wearing masks, subject to maintaining social distance, and so on. In this particular case, the police, they didn't handcuff her as they have in a horrible incident now moving across the internet in Sydney, or an even more horrible incident that happened in a country town in Victoria sometime earlier. What they did in this particular case was arrest the woman on the ground that whether she was entitled to exercise or not under the lockdown emergency power rules, she was not allowed to wear on her T-shirt and wear on the back of her on her back a placard and emblazoned on her mask, nicely attached between her ears across her mouth, protests and criticism of Daniel Andrews. In other words, she was being hit by the lockdown rule against her right to free speech. Now, in the state of Victoria, it's the only state in Australia which happens to have a constitution, Bill of Rights, just as we have in the United States, guaranteeing in law freedom of speech, freedom of association, freedom of movement, and that sort of thing. And all laws, including the law that's provided the health emergency powers, must be compatible with and not violate that constitution. So this lady went to the Victorian Supreme Court and argued earlier in the year that it was unlawful exercise of emergency power by Andrews, and in particular the chief medical officer, to enforce a law or enforce a power or a reg or an order that limited her free speech when she was doing her exercise. And the judge ruled in May, it's called the Cotterill case, that's the name of the woman who bravely fought this in court but lost. The judge ruled, and it's an incredible ruling, not covered properly in the Australian press and not understood outside. The judge ruled on the question, was the use of the emergency lockdown power lawfully come to by the medical expertise used? He didn't examine the full medical science. He simply said, did the medical experts hired by the state to give the state advice do the right thing according to the parliamentary legislation in advising what the risks would be for the general power? If they did, and he found that they did, then the general power to ban applied to what she had written on her back, on her mask, and on her T-shirt front. In other words, he found that the particular extension to suppressing this woman's free speech was lawful because the general application of emergency power had been recommended by a bunch of medicos. He didn't examine that those medicos are growing very rich in their think tanks out of state grants, out of state budget money provided by the very chief health officer whose advice is sought and whose advice is taken. In other words, you've legalized a gang to do what they want because they make money and votes at it. And it suppresses free speech, even though free speech is guaranteed in the law, because the judge rules that the constitutional right can be overruled if a bunch of medicos say it's in the medical interest of the emergency. Wow.
Well, and is that because the message that this woman had printed on her clothing was questioning the medical advice or the trying to bring into doubt the, quote, reality of COVID-19? Or was it more critical of the premier and the way he implemented it?
One slogan I remember, it was toot to boot. Took your car, if you're passing me, to boot the premier out of office. Toot to boot. Now, I think, I can't recall exactly, I should, but I can't. This legal judgment is a terror to read, 70, 80 pages of it. The mask said something unpleasant about Daniel Andrews. Dictator Dan is one of the slogans that have been used. The one I use, Little Hitler of Melbourne, wouldn't have fitted across the a mask, would it?
It depends but on how big the mouth was, I suppose.
Well, I've got a big mouth, but it wouldn't even fit across my mouth, would it?
Well, so this sounds just like political, that it was a political message, irregardless of the situation going on. People in Canada, I'm sure, at least where I live in the West here, could you describe what the lockdown means for you guys? I mean, we've had measures here, wearing masks and so forth, but most of it's been recommendations to social distance and stay at home. Don't travel if you don't have to. I haven't seen the army or the police chasing people down for jogging while wearing politically incorrect clothing or anything like that. Can you describe the mechanisms? Like, what does the lockdown mean, the Melbourne lockdown mean?
Well, let me describe what it looks like out my window and what it'll look like when I go outside to the shop. I work at a desk in front of a window, and the window views a busy street and a big park across the street. And it, because it's a hill, it's a favorite jogger's place. So lots of people like to jog up the street. They go up the street to a strip of coffee shops up the street, and they collect their cups of coffee. They have their coffee in the park, or they have their coffee on the way back down the street. And this is a form of exercise. It's a form of walking the dog. Incredible increase in the number of big dogs since the pandemic started. Now, during last year, I've been locked in since February of 2020. I can't get out of the country. What I would see is as follows. Police patrol cars would come down the street and up the street, moving slowly, looking at people. That would happen every couple of hours. I might see 6 to 10 police cars from the morning through the daylight hours into the early evening on the footpath, the sidewalk, police patrols, and then army patrols, soldiers. The police wore heavy arms. The soldiers did not wear arms. They would move in bands of fours or sixes or eights. They would go down the street, around the park, and if they had reason to tell people or order people or fine people or arrest people, they did. I didn't see that happening, but they moved in force. Then there'd be police patrols on horseback, and there'd be police patrols on bicycles. So the visibility of the police and the army, very high. And then that was last year. This year, what one can witness is police patrols coming and harassing the coffee shop owners, forcing them to, threatening them with $5,000 and $10,000 fines, enough to shut them up, if they did not make enforce the social distance rule of people on the sidewalk, prevent them from sitting down outside at tables, even though they were socially distanced and even if they were wearing masks. In other words, heavy arms being shown to shopkeepers to enforce distance and exclusion rules. The lockdown does not allow restaurants to open, but it does allow people to click and collect and collect food to take out or collect coffee. In my case, for example, the lockdown rules do not allow my wife and I to go together to a shop. One member only of a household is allowed to go shopping at a time. What would then happen if the car is spotted by a police patrol as having two people in it? Well, the only reasons you can, first of all, they'll put your number plate through their computer to determine whether you're more or less than 5 kilometers. The lockdown zone is 5 kilometers from your house. You can go out for only certain legislated or regulated purposes, one of which is to feed so that you don't starve to death. But if you're more than 5 kilometers, you'll have explaining to do to the police, and if they don't like your explanation, they can fine you. So first they'll check within the 5 kilometer range, and within the 5 kilometer range, the question is whether there's only one of you or two of you. Now, Andrews carefully calibrates the exceptions to this rule for votes. So transport workers, union members, moving buses that are empty, construction workers, individual entrepreneurs who are specialist trades like plumbing, electricians, house maintenance, that sort of thing, they can get permits. So permits for essential services allow you to drive around, allow you to go outside your 5 kilometer limit. So, but these exceptions don't relate to health purpose. They don't relate to infection risk. They relate to politics, votes, and money. Have I said enough? Does it sound pleasant? Oh, sorry, I can explain this to you. As concentration camps go, Australia isn't too bad. The weather's not bad. The fish are biting. The food isn't bad either. And I can still drink French wine.
Well, you can drink Australian wine too, I imagine. And that's an issue too that has some relevance. John, we're going to take a break and I'm going to play some commercials and music. We'll be right back with John Helmer talking about what's going on in Australia right now, his hometown in Melbourne. Well, I gotta think that we're not alone.
I'm sitting in my house watching all this happen, and I've arrived to a point where I just can't keep my mouth shut anymore.
Guerrilla Radio, every Thursday and Saturday at CFUV 101.9 FM. You're not alone. Well, John, where we left off, you were saying that, well, at least you can still drink French wine, but now it's coming on spring down there, and somebody's going to have to pick the Australian grapes to make wine down there right now. Here in Canada, during what lockdown we did have, which bears no resemblance to the draconian measures that you described before the break, but there are these things we call man camps, where they're basically extractive industry camps up in the north and interior of British Columbia, where they have hundreds of men that eat together, sleep together, work together in close quarters. these had never been shut down during at any time during this whole outbreak of COVID in 2020 until today. Who's picking your grapes? I mean, and we have the same thing with we've got migrant laborers coming in here as well, and foreign temporary workers to do mainly agricultural work. Who's going to pick the grapes in Australia?
Good question, Chris, and it's pretty much the same as you've just described. Call them migrant workers. In fact, they're contract workers who are going to be flown in from the Pacific Islands, from Fiji and various other islands to the north of Australia, probably on chartered aircraft, and brought in to live in fruit picking camps and harvest teams. Those people will be exempted from the draconian legislation. In other words, you've got certain things that are so politically powerful or so financially powerful that the politicians cannot resist, that create exemptions to the rules. Racehorses will be allowed into Australia from abroad, but not Australian citizens. For the Melbourne Cup and the racing season that comes in the spring, as you've just described. Fruit picking, harvesting, crop harvesting that requires skilled manpower, grapes, berries, and that sort of thing. They're all that work used to be divided between contract labor from the Pacific Islands and students from Europe and other countries taking a break year who would be given work visas and the right to tour around Australia so long as they put in several weeks or sometimes a month or more as contract labor. All the students are barred now, but the crops have to be harvested, the fruit has to be brought in, and that'll be done quite quietly without the press actually describing the degree to which the exemptions apply to them. The press in Australia is highly concentrated, more concentrated than almost any other so-called rule-governed democracy in the world, probably more concentrated than any other of the democracies. There's the state media, the Australian Broadcasting Commission, comparable to the CBC in Canada, plus Murdoch's press, which own roughly half of all the commercial media, and something called the Channel 9 Fairfax Group, which own newspapers and television stations, principally in Melbourne and Sydney. Now, they together black out a great many of the features of this emergency power by gangster system.
Well, John, your book, again, Hitler Didn't Die in Berlin. He moved to Melbourne, where he runs the state government of Victoria, a true COVID-19 thriller. As you mentioned, it began with the separation of you and your wife not able to fly into Australia from Russia, and you not able to leave Australia to see her. I'm amazed, John, that maybe you could explain it to me how I can understand why somebody would be barred from coming into the country for fear of spreading the contagion. Why would the Australian government restrict people leaving the country?
I think the view has been expressed to the federal parliament by MPs, by the prime minister and by his officials, that if you start to allow Australians to leave, they'll want to come back, and that will add to the risk of the re-entry and the pressure on the quarantine system to limit the risk. I think that's one of the alleged reasons for departure. But why non-Australian citizens, and now, because the rules are being tightened up, dual citizens, people who are citizens of other countries, are not allowed out, I'm not clear as to what the official public reason is. What the private reason, what the unpublished reasons are for all of these rules becomes clear, but you have to investigate the bureaucracies that manage to keep this stuff largely secret. And it usually has to do with state money and the limitations on the willingness of states to pay for quarantine. So they've passed the quarantine bill on to the people they imprison. Now, there's a very old rule in British law, Anglo-British law, common law, Canadian law, that the prisoner shouldn't be obliged to pay for his imprisonment. Imprisonment's usually considered punishment enough, but not that the prisoner should pay for it. In Australia, what's happened is that quarantine is now charged to incoming individuals at $3,000 a pop for an individual and up to $6,000 for a family. And the illegality of that can be documented, but that's another story. We haven't gotten that far yet.
There was the whole controversy and scandal of the so-called quarantine hotels last year. And I'm looking in the online at news stories that, well, now Australia is going from quarantine hotels to quarantine holiday camps, or more properly, centers for national resilience, that are being described by certain political quarters as being COVID concentration camps.
There's a bit of this in the book. There's much more to tell. Basically, the quarantine system uniquely leaked in Melbourne, and because it leaked to generate the second wave of infection in Melbourne and Victoria and causing more lockdowns, there was a so-called independent state investigation. So Victoria also leads the world in having established a government investigation of how the quarantine system leaked the infection and why. It was an enormous investigation. I quote a lot of it from the book, or in the book, but it made a number of recommendations to the Premier, all of which he ignored. But it wasn't independent at all, in the sense that the quarantine hotel system's cost was never disclosed by the Premier to the retired judge presiding, or to the lawyers arguing the case, or through the witnesses. What the investigation showed was the police commanding the quarantine operation for incoming travellers didn't quite know what laws they were enforcing and what orders, if there was a conflict of orders, to follow. The quarantine hotels' independent investigation shows were charging the state at far higher price than their old retail room prices were before lockdown occurred. So they were cleaning up financially, profiteering. So were the healthcare companies, which signed health monitoring contracts with the Premier Andrews, the details of which have not been disclosed. The police cleaned up by getting bonuses, overtime payments and stuff, none of which has been disclosed to Parliament. The private hospitals paid to reserve space for a COVID wave that never happened, have been paid and are still being paid to stay close to certain kinds of so-called non-emergency care. What we have here is a system that was entirely corrupt, but was not analysed by the investigation. Instead, one minister, the health minister, got the sack, and one or two senior civil servants resigned, but no criminal charges, no investigation of criminal offences followed. The Premier ignored the results, and the thousands of interesting pages of witness testimony and financial evidence was buried. Thousands of pages were buried. So, yes, there was an investigation. No, there were no results. So what we have is another case of the way in which gangsterism works to prevent all the normal organs of accountability, all required. Victoria and Australia have good progressive laws regulating, you'd think, emergency powers. But they've been completely suppressed and ignored by the press, by the parliament, by the courts. What else is left?
In a letter to me, I don't know if you've published this elsewhere, and I hope I don't embarrass you by quoting it, but you said to me that as it stands right now, there's no basis for believing anything issued by the state-funded think tanks, state and federal health officers, any of the politicians responsible, any of the Australian courts, any of the media, whether state, Murdoch, or Channel 9 Fairfax. It brings me to the idea that trust, when some scratch their heads and wonder on one side of this issue, how could people not go and get vaccinated? How could they doubt? It's all a matter of trust. And when the trust, not only in Australia, but across Western democracy, has been so eroded over these last few decades, I would argue, this seems to me to be the most salient issue of the moment.
It is indeed. And far be it from me to disagree with myself, okay? but let's say, paradoxically, what the effect of one and approaching 2 years of this sort of rule by diktat does, the effect is to generate passive resistance and total distrust of what people read. Yes, the opinion polls show that certain politicians, certain incumbent politicians like Andrews, maintain popular support, especially among females under the age of 35. Those polls, to some extent, manipulated, but the questions are rigged because the alternatives that people might have in their minds, in their political choices, don't exist. They don't exist because they're not in the media. They're not in the media because they're repressed and suppressed. Now, what this produces, and all Canadians understand this, everybody around the world understands this, when you lose trust, but you're afraid to express it because there's an armed policeman walking past who will crush you if you express it, what you generate is not only distrust, but deep anger. Anger plus distrust are the two elements that generate, on the one hand, conspiracy theories that are lunacy in the social media, which in turn are partly provoked by the state. Agents provocateurs are everywhere now in the social media, triggering displays of violence, which are then used to bring on police enforcement in such a way as to frighten people further. So fear, fright, terror become weapons of the state, and anger and passive resistance destroy the capability of a scientific establishment to do its job, get to the truth. They destroy the ability of media to tell us what the real impact of vaccination might be. In fact, and this isn't a discussion about the rights and wrongs, the scientific data of vaccination or the current vaccines that are available. But let's just put it this way. In the UK, in Israel, and in other places, we're seeing scientific records of data that deserve to be debated in the parliaments of the states also using those vaccines. In a state ruled by fear and anger and by diktat of the local politicians, there's no telling whether vaccine is a highly effective or no better effective than a flu vaccine. You see, the irony is that if you force people, as people are being forced all over the world, to do something, to run a risk that the state will not take liability for, that pharmaceutical companies will not accept liability for, if you force people to do that, you run into resistance, anger, and distrust, so that nothing anyone says can be believed. So it's no longer a case that watch out for the conspiracy theories in the social media. It's a case of watch out for the conspiracy of falsification from your local health officer. I see cases of this all over the United States. There's a very interesting case on the island of Maui in Hawaii, where the chief health officer there, a former Marine, a former U.S. Army doctor, has had a doctor, Lauren Pang, P-A-N-G, has come under attack for daring to say a few things, not against vaccination, but against the medications he believes might be useful in treating COVID-19 patients on the island of Maui. So what I'm saying here, stuck where I am, isn't a story just about the way Australian fascism works. It's a story about the sociology of pandemics, when fear produces anger and anger produces distrust of everything the state says, good, bad, true, and false.
Well, you said that by hook or by crook, and by hook is the police and military, the fear of the police and military repression, and by crook, the politicos and their friends in the media constantly reinforcing messages that may or may not be in your the citizens' best interest. I saw you talk you and Ajay Goyal had online just put up, and in that discussion you mentioned that the forthcoming elections in Canada and in Germany and in Russia as well, and this idea that the whether it's because of these issues we've been discussing or just the lockdown weariness, incumbent politicians in those countries all face a steep uphill climb. Before we went on air today, John, you were mentioning there's been some late breaking news in Victoria State. Do you want to use that to bring us into the larger political scenarios that you see playing out?
The parochial news, for somebody listening to this program in British Columbia, the only interest here is what this bodes for the future of Prime Minister Trudeau and Deputy Prime Minister Freeland, not long away now. What's happened in Victoria is that after a year and a half, nearly 2 years now, of Andrews using a very clear majority in the lower house of parliament and leading the polls in popularity, what he's now facing is that the local Tories last night spilled their leadership, got rid of the leader who was considered to be ineffective, and he certainly was. And the Tories, they called the Liberal Party here, but I'd rather call them Tories because everybody understands what a Tory is and nobody understands what a Liberal is. Not even in Canada can you understand what a Liberal is these days if Freeland is the Deputy Prime Minister of Canadian Liberalism. Okay, so what's happened is a spill. The Conservatives are going to have somebody who's a lot more active, and he's going to announce publicly that he supports and his party supports all of the groups that Andrews figured he could dispose of, disadvantage, and whose votes didn't count in his calculation of how to run the emergency powers and try to protect the population from the health risk. So I mentioned that happened here overnight. What happened in Canada overnight, but a few weeks back, was Mr. Trudeau figured, look, I better call an election right now. Forgive me if I've got this wrong, Chris. You correct me. He thought things can only get worse between now and when I would normally come up for election in terms of the economy. That'll go badly for me now. What I'll count on now is that people feel safer with me in charge than the risk of picking another lot, the Canadian Tories or the NDP. So he called a snap election with the shortest possible time to give people the shortest possible opportunity to think for themselves. What he didn't calculate was the Canadians can think for themselves rather speedily. After all, we're all locked at home. What else have we got to do but think for ourselves? And so he's triggered a wave of turning this resistance into anger, into support for anyone but Trudeau. I suppose that's going to mean NDP support, and it means a kind of all sorts of interesting somersaults on the part of the Tories to capitalize on this underlying disaffection. Is that the way you read it, Chris?
Well, he's following the example, whether deliberately or not, of the provincial leader here in British Columbia who last year called a snap election, thinking, I believe, that things can only get worse. He wanted to go from a minority to a majority government. He succeeded. Trudeau is in the same position now. He's in a minority position. He wants to have a majority. The opposition is really not very organized, and they're led by people that are lacking charisma and lacking the ability to fire the imagination of the Canadian electorate. What you didn't mention, John, too, is that Trudeau is calling an election during the summertime, which is really a no-no here in Canada politically. So there's many reasons for people to be upset with him, the COVID response being one of them, and the fact that he has lied so elegantly and so often to the Canadian public about so many things that he is he's not nearly as popular as his inner circle might lead him to believe. And now the woeful opposition actually does have a chance, and it's going to be a very narrow, my prediction is it's going to be a very narrow thing here.
Let's zip across the Atlantic, Chris, so that Canadians can watch what will happen in the Russian election, which takes place on September 17 to 19. In Russia, the passive resistance, the anger at the behavior of local authority, state or regional authority, and federal authority, that anger is going to translate not into voting for opposition to President Putin and the United Russia majority rule party in the parliament, but rather to not vote at all. So you can vote in Victoria and Australia, voting is compulsory. In Russia, turnout, voting for no one, not voting, is going to be, in 2 weeks' time, one of the most vivid indicators of Russian disaffection and Russian anger and Russian resistance. After the Canadian vote result is clear 21st of September, if it's clear, we'll have the German election. Germany's the most important country in Europe, as we all understand, and Mrs. Merkel is leaving a party that's going to lose. I mean, it's down the momentum for the CDU, Christian Democratic Union, Mrs. Merkel's party, the incumbent political party, is facing downward momentum as German voters decide who to choose. And what's the future for Germany may be a two- or three-way coalition, Greens, Social Democratic Party, and some others, to exclude the party off power in Germany for almost a generation. Now, these are lessons for, if you're a politician, for not miscalculating on the basis of your own rigged polls, of not miscalculating what people mean by success in not dying of COVID-19, what people mean by vaccination and vaccination effectiveness and vaccination risk and so forth. We're not here to argue those very important issues for people's health, for people's risk, and for the health of a country. What we're arguing, what we're saying here is the effect of force, the effect of suppression, the effect of sustained propaganda and corruption in the award of money has destroyed public trust to an extent that you don't see in the democracies except in wartime. And we're in war. Obviously, for Russia, wartime started, roughly speaking, 2014. The regime change, the information warfare, the Ukraine front, the Syrian front, these are fronts of the war against Russia to change the ruling power in Russia from NATO, Canada, and the Western Alliance. So wartime isn't new for Russians. Wartime conditions for Russians have protected incumbency. We'll see very shortly whether the domestic distrust reflects itself in a very low turnout. And in Canada, we'll see what the outcome is for Mr. Trudeau's calculation. And then we'll see who will rule Germany, if anybody can rule in Germany. A three-way coalition, Greens, Social Democrats, and Free Democrats in Germany is kind of ungovernable.
And what about Daniel Andrews, the premier of Victoria State, where you are? When does he have to face the music?
Not until next year, but the idea that he would go for a snap election on the same basis that you've just explained in British Columbia. And you see, he's got a very strong majority in the lower house. He has a very weak majority in the upper house of the state parliament. We inherited bicameral houses of parliament from British colonial times, and the federal parliament the same. But the way Andrews rules in the upper house is by building coalitions that he can feed with money. Little parties with two or three people, Greens, animal rights. I think there's a free sex party, but I don't know that it's either about free or sex. It is about collecting money. And collecting money is what the Premier likes to hand out. And so with these so-called cross-bench minority parties, he can add 10 to 12 votes to his majority. And that means that the Tories in the upper house are silent and are silenced. So the difference in the Victorian provincial case, and I have to stress, I don't mean to be talking parochially and provincially. I'm trying to say, think, folks, about how this applies to you. The difference that the Andrews' political position is that he already has a commanding majority. Why would he call an early election to risk it? Only if he were convinced that the future would be worse for that controlling majority. Well, the situation on the Tory side here was they would wait, and this is what their people have told me. I don't know if it's true. They would wait till Andrews wins again next year in order to shake up the leadership of their party and make a pitch outside of the environment of the pandemic and the emergency, but outside of the fear, outside of the anger. Well, it seems that that calculation was overruled last night, and now the Tories really feel invigorated that they can go after the Premier. And now he's got possibly a real fight on, because what will then happen is that the media will have to choose politically. Maybe the Murdoch media will go for the Tory, and leaving Channel 9, the state media, and the Fairfax Group to support Andrews. It's a completely different situation party-wise in New South Wales. And in the federal government, it's a much narrower majority. And that majority may push, that is so tiny, it may push the Prime Minister of Australia, a man named Scott Morrison, to an early election. But I'm a Russia correspondent. I don't claim to be expert on this. I'm trying to find, in these examples, what apply to us all.
Well, John, we're fast running out of time, but I want people to remember your book, Hitler Didn't Die in Berlin. He moved to Melbourne, where he runs the state government of Victoria, a true COVID-19 thriller. You can go to John Helmer's site, johnhelmer.net, and find out how you can order his book outside of Australia. But thanks a lot, John, for coming on again. And I want everyone to remember there's great programming coming up, so just stick around for that. That's all I've got, though, for you for this week. Until the next time, thanks, John.
Thank you very much, Chris. Stay well.